to his feet. "Ghost!" He turned toward the wood, and there he came, padding silently out of the green dusk, the breath coming warm and white from his open jaws. "Ghost!" he shouted, and the direwolf broke into a run. He was leaner than he had been, but bigger as well, and the only sound he made was a soft crunch of dead leaves beneath his paws. When he reached John, he leapt, and they wrestled amidst brown grass and long shadows as the stars came out above them. "God's wolf, where have you been?" John said, when Ghost stopped worrying at his forearm. "I thought you died on me, like Rob and Egret and all the rest. I've had no sense of you, not since I climbed the wall, not even in dreams." The direwolf had no answer, but he licked John's face with a tongue like a wet rasp, and his eyes caught the last light and shone like two great red suns. Red eyes, John realized, but not like Melisandre. He had a weirwood's eyes. Red eyes, red mouth, white fur, blood and bone, like a heart tree. He belongs to the old gods, this one. And he alone of all the direwolves was white. Six pups they'd found in the late summer snows, him and Rob, five that were grey and black and brown, for the five Starks, and one white as snow. He had his answer then. Beneath the wall, the Queen's men were kindling their night fire. He saw Melisandre emerge from the tunnel with the King beside her, to lead the prayers she believed would keep the dark away. "Come, Ghost," John told the wolf, "with me. You're hungry, I know. I can feel it." They ran together for the gate, circling wide around the night fire, where reaching flames clawed at the black belly of the night. The King's men were much in evidence in the yards of Castle Black. They stopped as John went by and gaped at him. None of them had ever seen a direwolf before, he realized, and Ghost was twice as large as the common wolves that prowled their southern greenwoods. As he walked towards the armory, John chanced to look up and saw Val standing in her tower window. "I'm sorry," he thought. "I'm not the man to steal you out of there." In the practice yard, he came upon a dozen King's men with torches and long spears in their hands. The sergeant looked at Ghost and scowled, and a couple of his men lowered their spears until the knight who led them said, "Move aside and let them pass." To John he said, "You're late for your supper." "Then get out of my way, sir," John replied, and he did. He could hear the noise even before he reached the bottom of the steps, raised voices, curses, someone pounding on a table. John stepped into the vault, all but unnoticed. His brothers crowded the benches and the tables, but more were standing and shouting than were sitting, and no one was eating. There was no food. "What's happening here?" Lord Janus Flint was bellying about turncloaks and treason. Iron Emmet stood on a table with a naked sword in his fist. Three-finger Hub was cursing a ranger from the Shadow Tower. Some East Watch man slammed his fist onto the table again and again, demanding quiet. But all that did was add to the din echoing off the vaulted ceiling. Pip was the first to see John. He grinned at the sight of Ghost, put two fingers in his mouth, and whistled as only a mama's boy could whistle. The shrill sound cut through the clamour like a sword. As John walked toward the tables, more of the brothers took note and fell quiet. A hush fell across the cellar, until the only sounds were John's heels clicking on the stone floor, and the soft crackle of the lugs in the hearth. Sir Alistair Thorne shattered the silence. "The turncloak graces us with his presence at last." Lord Janus was red-faced and quivering. "The beast!" he gasped. "Look, the beast that tore the life from Halfhand! A warg walks amongst us, brothers! A warg! This creature is not fit to lead us! This beastling is not fit to live!" Ghost bared his teeth, but John put a hand on his head. "My lord," he said, "will you tell me what's happened here?" Maester Aemon answered from the far end of the hall, "Your name has been put forth as Lord Commander, John." That was so absurd, John had to smile. "By who?" he said, looking for his friends. This had to be one of Pip's japes, surely. But Pip shrugged at him, and Gran shook his head. It was Dolorous Ed Tullet who stood.
"Called by me, aye, eh? It's a terrible thing to do to a friend, but better you than me, eh?"
Lord Janus started sputtering again.
This is an outrage! We ought to hang this boy. Yes, hang him, I say. Hang him for a turncloak and a warg, along with his friend Mance Reader. Lord Commander, I will not have it. I will not suffer it."
Cutter Pike stood up.
"You won't suffer it. Might be you had those gold cloaks trained to lick your bloody ass, but you're wearing a black cloak now. Any brother may offer any name for our consideration, so long as the man has said his vows,"
Sir Denis Mallister said.
"Tollet is well within his rights, my lord."
A dozen men started to talk at once, each trying to drown out the others, and before long half the hall was shouting once more. This time it was Sir Alistair Thorne who leapt onto the table and raised his hands for quiet.
"Brothers," he cried, "this gains us naught. I say we vote. This king, who has taken the king's tower, has posted men at all the doors to see that we do not eat nor leave till we've made a choice. So be it. We will choose and choose again, all night if need be, until we have our lord. But before we cast our tokens, I believe our first builder has something to say to us."
Uthul Yarvik stood up slowly, frowning. The big builder rubbed his long lantern jaw and said,
"Well, I'm pulling my name out. If you wanted me, you had 10 chances to choose me, and you didn't. Not enough of you, anyway. I was going to say that those who are casting a token for me ought to choose Lord Janus."
Sir Alistair nodded.
"Lord Slint is the best possible—"
"I wasn't done, Alistair,"
Yarwick complained.
"Lord Slint commanded the City Watch in King's Landing, we all know, and he was Lord of Harrenhal."
"He's never seen Harrenhal," Cutter Pike shouted up.
"Well, that's so," said Yarwick. "Anyway, now that I'm standing here, I don't recall why I thought Slint would be such a good choice. That would be a sort of kicking King Stannis in the mouth, and I don't see how that serves us. Might be Snow would be better. He's been longer on the wall. He's Ben Stark's nephew, and he served the old bear as squire."
Yarwick shrugged.
"Pick who you want, just so it's not me."
He sat down. Janus Slint had turned from red to purple, John saw, but Sir Alistair Thorne had gone pale. The Eastwatch man was pounding his fist on the table again, but now he was shouting for the kettle. Some of his friends took up the cry. "Kettle!" they roared as one. "Kettle! Kettle! Kettle!" The kettle was in the corner by the hearth, a big black pot-bellied thing with two huge handles and a heavy lid. Maester Aemon said a word to Sam and Clydus, and they went and grabbed the handles and dragged the kettle over to the table. A few of the brothers were already queuing up by the token barrels, as Clydus took the lid off and almost dropped it on his foot. With a raucous scream and a clap of wings, a huge raven burst out of the kettle. It flapped upward, seeking the rafters, perhaps, or a window to make its escape. But there were no rafters in the vault, nor windows either. The raven was trapped. Cawing loudly, it circled the hall once, twice, three times. And John heard Samwell Tarly shout,
"I know that bird. That's Lord Mormont's raven."
The raven landed on the table nearest John.
"Snow!"
it cawed. It was an old bird, dirty and bedraggled.
"Snow!"
it said again.
"Snow! Snow! Snow!"
It walked to the end of the table, spread its wings again, and flew to John's shoulder. Lord Janus Lint sat down so heavily he made a thump, but Sir Alistair filled the vault with mocking laughter.
"Sir Piggy thinks we're all fools, brothers," he said. "He's taught the bird this little trick. They all say, Snow, go up to the rookery and hear for yourselves. Mormont's bird had more words than that."
The raven cocked its head and looked at John.
"Corn,"
it said hopefully. When it got neither corn nor answer, it quawked and muttered,
"Kettle! Kettle! Kettle!"
The rest was arrowheads, a torrent of arrowheads, a flood of arrowheads, arrowheads enough to drown the last few stones and shells and all the copper pennies, too. When the count was done, John found himself surrounded. Some clapped him on the back, whilst others bent the knee to him, as if he were a lord in truth. Satin, Owen the Oaf, Halder, Toad, Spareboot, Giant, Mully, Ulmer of the Kingswood, Sweet Donal Hill, and half a hundred more pressed around him. Dywin clacked his wooden teeth and said,
"Gosh be good, our Lord Commander's still in swaddling clothes."
Arne Emmett said, "I hope this don't mean I can't beat the bloody piss out of you next time you train, my lord." Three-Finger Hub wanted to know if he'd still be eating with the men, or if he'd want his meal sent up to Solar. Even Bowen Marsh came up to say he would be glad to continue as Lord Steward, if that was Lord Snow's wish.
"Lord Snow," said Cutter Pike, "if you muck this up, I'm going to rip your liver out and eat it raw with onions."
Sir Dennis Mallister was more courteous.
"It was a hard thing, young Samuel Astromy," the old knight confessed. "When Lord Corgill was chosen, I told myself, 'No matter, he's been on the wall longer than you have, your time will come.' When it was Lord Mormont, I thought, 'He's strong and fierce, but he's old, your time may yet come.' But you're half a boy, Lord Snow, and now I must return to the Shadow Tower, knowing that my time will never come."
He smiled a tired smile.
"Do not make me die regretful. Your uncle was a great man. Your lord father, and his father as well. I shall expect full as much of you."
"Aye," said Cutter Pike, "and you can start by telling those king's men that it's done, and we want our bloody supper."
"Supper!"
screamed the raven.
"Supper! Supper!"
The king's men cleared the door when they told them of the choosing, and Three-Finger Hub and half a dozen helpers went trotting off to the kitchen to fetch the food. John did not wait to eat. He walked across the castle, wondering if he were dreaming, with the raven on his shoulder and Ghost at his heels. Pip, Gren, and Sam trailed after him, chattering. But he hardly heard a word until Gren whispered,
"Sam did it."
And Pip said,
"Sam did it."
Pip had brought a wineskin with him, and he took a long drink and chanted,
"Sam, Sam the wizard, Sam the wonder, Sam, Sam the marvel man, he did it." "But when did you hide the raven in the kettle, Sam? And how in seven hells could you be certain it would fly to John? It would have mucked up everything if the bird had decided to perch on Janus Slint's fat head." "I had nothing to do with the bird," Sam insisted. "When it flew out of the kettle, I almost wet myself."
John laughed, half amazed that he still remembered how. "You're all a bunch of mad fools. Do you know that?"
"Us?" said Pip. "You call us fools? We're not the ones who got chosen as the 998th Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. You'd best have some wine, Lord John. I think you're going to need a lot of wine."
So John Snow took the wineskin from his hand and had a swallow. But only one. The wall was his. The night was dark. And he had a king to face. Sansa. She awoke all at once, every nerve a tingle. For a moment she did not remember where she was. She had dreamt that she was little, still sharing a bedchamber with her sister Arya. But it was her maid she heard tossing in sleep, not her sister, and this was not Winterfell, but the Eyrie. And I am Elaine Stone, a bastard girl. The room was cold and black, though she was warm beneath the blankets. Dawn had not yet come. Sometimes she dreamed of Sir Ilyen Payne and woke with her heart thumping. But this dream had not been like that. Home. It was a dream of home. The Eyrie was no home. It was no bigger than Maegor's Holdfast, but outside its sheer white walls was only the mountain and the long, treacherous descent past sky and snow and stone to the gates of the moon on the valley floor. There was no place to go, and little to do. The older servant said these halls rang with laughter when her father and Robert Baratheon had been John Arryn's wards, but those days were many years gone. Her aunt kept a small household, and seldom permitted any guest to ascend past the gates of the moon. Aside from her aged maid, Sansa's only companion was the Lord Robert, 8 going on 3. And Marillion. There is always Marillion. When he played for them at supper, the young singer often seemed to be singing directly at her. Her aunt was far from pleased. Lady Lysa doted on Marillion, and had banished 2 serving girls and even a page for telling lies about him. Lysa was as lonely as she was. Her new husband seemed to spend more time at the foot of the mountain than he did atop it. He was gone now, had been gone the past 4 days, meeting with the Corbrys. From bits and pieces of overheard conversations, Sansa knew that John Arryn's bannermen resented Lysa's marriage, and begrudged Petar his authority as Lord Protector of the Vale. The senior branch of House Royce was close to open revolt over her aunt's failure to aid Rob in his war, and the Wainwoods, Redforts, Belmores, and Templetons were giving them every support. The mountain clans were being troublesome as well, and old Lord Hunter had died so suddenly that his 2 younger sons were accusing their elder brother of having murdered him. The Vale of Arryn might have been spared the worst of the war, but it was hardly the idyllic place that Lady Lysa had made it out to be. "I am not going back to sleep," Sansa realized. "My head is all a tumult." She pushed her pillow away reluctantly, threw back the blankets, went to her window, and opened the shutters. Snow was falling on the Eyrie. Outside, the flakes drifted down as soft and silent as memory. Was this what woke me? Already the snowfall lay thick upon the garden below, blanketing the grass, dusting the shrubs and statues with white, and weighing down the branches of the trees. The sight took Sansa back to cold nights long ago in the long summer of her childhood. She had last seen snow the day she'd left Winterfell. That was a lighter fall than this, she remembered. Rob had melting flakes in his hair when he hugged me, and the snowball Arya tried to make kept coming apart in her hands. It hurt to remember how happy she had been that morning. Helen had helped her mount, and she'd ridden out with the snowflakes swirling around her, off to see the great wide world. I thought my song was beginning that day, but it was almost done. Sansa left the shutters open as she dressed. It would be cold, she knew, though the Eyrie's towers encircled the garden and protected it from the worst of the mountain winds. She donned silken small clothes and a linen shift, and over that a warm dress of blue lamb's wool. 2 pairs of hose for her legs, boots that laced up to her knees, heavy leather gloves, and finally a hooded cloak of soft white fox fur. Her maid rolled herself more tightly in her blanket as the snow began to drift in the window. Sansa eased open the door and made her way down the winding stair. When she opened the door to the garden, it was so lovely that she held her breath, unwilling to disturb such perfect beauty. The snow drifted down and down, all in ghostly silence, and lay thick and unbroken on the ground. All colour had fled the world outside. It was a place of whites and blacks and greys. White towers and white snow and white statues, black shadows and black trees. The dark grey sky above. A pure world, Sansa thought. I do not belong here. Yet she stepped out all the same. Her boots tore ankle-deep holes into the smooth, white surface of the snow, yet made no sound. Sansa drifted past frosted shrubs and thin, dark trees, and wondered if she was still dreaming. Drifting snowflakes brushed her face as light as lovers' kisses, and melted on her cheeks. At the center of the garden, beside the statue of the weeping woman, that lay broken and half buried on the ground, she turned her face up to the sky and closed her eyes. She could feel the snow on her lashes, taste it on her lips. It was the taste of Winterfell, the taste of innocence, the taste of dreams. When Sansa opened her eyes again, she was on her knees. She did not remember falling. It seemed to her that the sky was a lighter shade of grey. Dawn, she thought. Another day. Another new day. It was the old days she hungered for, prayed for. But who could she pray to? The garden had been meant for a god's wood once, she knew. But the soil was too thin and stony for a weirwood to take root. A god's wood without gods. As empty as me. She scooped up a handful of snow and squeezed it between her fingers. Heavy and wet, the snow packed easily. Sansa began to make snowballs, shaping and smoothing them until they were round and white and perfect. She remembered a summer's snow in Winterfell, when Arya and Bran had ambushed her as she emerged from the keep one morning. They'd each had a dozen snowballs to hand, and she'd had none. Bran had been perched on the roof of the covered bridge out of reach, but Sansa had chased Arya through the stables and around the kitchen until both of them were breathless. She might even have caught her, but she slipped on some ice. Her sister came back to see if she was hurt. When she said she wasn't, Arya hit her in the face with another snowball, but Sansa grabbed her leg and pulled her down and was rubbing snow in her hair when Jorah came along and pulled them apart, laughing. "What do I want with snowballs?" She looked at her sad little arsenal. "There's no one to throw them at." She let the one she was making drop from her hand. "I could build a snow knight instead," she thought, "or even..." She pushed two of her snowballs together, added a third, packed more snow in around them, and patted the whole thing into the shape of a cylinder. When it was done, she stood it on end and used the tip of her little finger to poke holes in it for windows. The crenellations around the top took a little more care, but when they were done, she had a tower. "I need some walls now," Sansa thought, "and then a keep." She set to work. The snow fell and the castle rose. Two walls ankle high, the inner taller than the outer, towers and turrets, keeps and stairs, a round kitchen, a square armory, the stables along the inside of the west wall. It was only a castle when she began, but before very long Sansa knew it was Winterfell. She found twigs and fallen branches beneath the snow and broke off the ends to make the trees for the godswood. For the gravestones in the lich yard she used bits of bark. Soon her gloves and her boots were crusty white, her hands were tingling, and her feet were soaked and cold, but she did not care. The castle was all that mattered. Some things were hard to remember, but most came back to her easily, as if she had been there only yesterday. The library tower, with the steep stonework stair twisting about its exterior. The gatehouse, two huge bulwarks, the arched gate between them, crenellations all along the top. And all the while the snow kept falling, piling up in drifts around her buildings, as fast as she raised them. She was patting down the pitched roof of the great hall when she heard a voice, and looked up to see her maid calling from her window. "Was my lady well?" Did she wish to break her fast? Sansa shook her head and went back to shaping snow, adding a chimney to one end of the great hall, where the hearth would stand inside. Dawn stole into her garden like a thief. The grey of the sky grew lighter still, and the trees and shrubs turned a dark green beneath their stoles of snow. A few servants came out and watched her for a time, but she paid them no mind, and they soon went back inside, where it was warmer. Sansa saw Lady Lysa gazing down from her balcony, wrapped up in a blue velvet robe trimmed with fox fur, but when she looked again, her aunt was gone. Maester Coleman popped out of the rookery and peered down for a while, skinny and shivering but curious. Her bridges kept falling down. There was a covered bridge between the armory and the main keep, and another that went from the fourth floor of the bell tower to the second floor of the rookery. But no matter how carefully she shaped them, they would not hold together. The third time one collapsed on her, she cursed aloud and sat back in helpless frustration. "Pack the snow around a stick, Sansa." She did not know how long he had been watching her, or when he had returned from the Vale. "A stick?" she asked. "That will give it strength enough to stand, I think," Pataya said. "May I come into your castle, milady?" Sansa was wary. "Don't break it, be gentle," he smiled. "Winterfell has withstood fiercer enemies than me. It is Winterfell, is it not?" "Yes," Sansa admitted. He walked along outside the walls. "I used to dream of it in those years after Cat went north with Eddard Stark. In my dreams, it was ever a dark place and cold."
"No, it was always warm, even when it snowed. Water from the hot springs is piped through the walls to warm them, and inside the glass gardens it was always like the hottest day of summer."
She stood towering over the great white castle.
"I can't think how to do the glass roof over the gardens."
Littlefinger stroked his chin, where his beard had been before Lysa had asked him to shave it off. "The glass was locked in frames, no? Twigs are your answer. Peel them and cross them and use bark to tie them together into frames. I'll show you." He moved through the garden, gathering up twigs and sticks and shaking the snow from them. When he had enough, he stepped over both walls with a single long stride and squatted on his heels in the middle of the yard. Sansa came closer to watch what he was doing. His hands were deft and sure, and before long he had a criss-crossing latticework of twigs, very like the one that roofed the glass gardens of Winterfell. "We will need to imagine the glass, to be sure," he said when he gave it to her.
"This is just right," she said.
He touched her face.
"And so is that."
Sansa did not understand.
"And so is what?"
"Your smile, my lady. Shall I make another for you?"
"If you would."
"Nothing could please me more."
She raised the walls of the glass gardens while Littlefinger roofed them over, and when they were done with that, he helped her extend the walls and build the guards' hall. When she used sticks for the covered bridges, they stood, just as he had said they would. The first keep was simple enough, an old round drum tower, but Sansa was stymied again when it came to putting the gargoyles around the top. Again he had the answer.
"It's been snowing on your castle, milady," he pointed out. "What do gargoyles look like when they're covered with snow?"
Sansa closed her eyes to see them in memory.
"They're just white lumps."
"Well then, gargoyles are hard, but white lumps should be easy."
And they were. The broken tower was easier still. They made a tall tower together, kneeling side by side to roll it smooth, and when they raised it, Sansa stuck her fingers through the top, grabbed a handful of snow, and flung it full in his face. Pataya yelped as the snow slid down under his collar.
"That was unchivalrously done, my lady."
"As was bringing me here when you swore to take me home."
She wondered where this courage had come from.
to speak to him so frankly. From Winterfell, she thought. I am stronger within the walls of Winterfell. His face grew serious.
Yes, I played you false in that, and in one other thing as well.
Sansa's stomach was aflutter. What other thing?
I told you that nothing could please me more than to help you with your castle. I fear that was a lie as well. Something else would please me more.
He stepped closer.
This.
Sansa tried to step back, but he pulled her into his arms, and suddenly he was kissing her. Feebly, she tried to squirm, but only succeeded in pressing herself more tightly against him. His mouth was on hers, swallowing her words. He tasted of mint. For half a heartbeat, she yielded to his kiss, before she turned her face away and wrenched free.
"What are you doing?"
Pataya straightened his cloak.
"Kissing a snow maid."
"You're supposed to kiss her,"
Sansa glanced up at Lysa's balcony. But it was empty now.
"Your lady wife."
"I do. Lysa has no cause for complaint."
He smiled.
"I wish you could see yourself, my lady. You are so beautiful. You're crusted over with snow like some little bear cub. But your face is flushed, and you can scarcely breathe. How long have you been out here? You must be very cold. Let me warm you, Sansa. Take off those gloves. Give me your hands."
"I won't." He sounded almost like Marillion, the night he'd gotten so drunk at the wedding. Only this time, Lothar Brune would not appear to save her. Sir Lothar was Pataya's man.
"You shouldn't kiss me. I might have been your own daughter."
"Might have been," he admitted with a rueful smile. "But you're not, are you? You're Eddard Stark's daughter, and Kat's. But I think you might be even more beautiful than your mother was, when she was your age."
"Pataya, please."
Her voice sounded so weak.
"Please?" "A castle!"
The voice was loud, shrill, and childish. Littlefinger turned away from her.
"Lord Robert," he sketched a bow. "Should you be out in the snow without your gloves?"
"Did you make the snow castle, Lord Littlefinger?"
"Elaine did most of it, my lord."
Sansa said, "It's meant to be Winterfell."
"Winterfell?"
Robert was small for 8, a stick of a boy with splotchy skin and eyes that were always runny. Under one arm he clutched the threadbare cloth doll he carried everywhere. "Winterfell is the seat of House Stark," Sansa told her husband-to-be. "The great castle of the north."
"It's not so great."
The boy knelt before the gatehouse.
"Look, here comes a giant to knock it down."
He stood his doll in the snow and moved it jerkily.
"Trump, Trump, I'm a giant, I'm a giant,"
he chanted.
"Ho, ho, ho, open your gates, or I'll mash them and smash them."
Swinging the doll by the legs, he knocked the top off one gatehouse tower and then the other. It was more than Sansa could stand.
"Robert, stop that!"
Instead, he swung the doll again, and a foot of wall exploded. She grabbed for his hand, but she caught the doll instead. There was a loud ripping sound as the thin cloth tore. Suddenly, she had the doll's head. Robert had the legs and body, and the rag and sawdust stuffing was spilling in the snow. Lord Robert's mouth trembled.
"You killed him!"
he wailed. Then he began to shake. It started with no more than a little shivering, but within a few short heartbeats he had collapsed across the castle, his limbs flailing about violently. White towers and snowy bridges shattered and fell on all sides. Sansa stood horrified, but Pataya Baelish seized her cousin's wrists and shouted for the maester. Guards and serving girls arrived within instants to help restrain the boy. Maester Coleman a short time later. Robert Arryn's shaking sickness was nothing new to the people of the Eyrie, and Lady Lysa had trained them all to come rushing at the boy's first cry. The maester held the little lord's hand and gave him half a cup of dream wine, murmuring soothing words. Slowly, the violence of the fit seemed to ebb away till nothing remained but a small shaking of the hands.
"Help him to my chambers,"
Coleman told the guards.
"A leechin will help calm him."
"It was my fault," Sansa showed them the doll's head. I ripped his doll in two. I never meant to, but..."
"His lordship was destroying the castle," said Pataya.
"A giant,"
the boy whispered, weeping.
"It wasn't me. It was a giant hurt the castle. She killed him. I hate her. She's a bastard, and I hate her. I don't want to be leeched."
"My lord, your blood needs thinning," said Maester Coleman. "It is the bad blood that makes you angry, and the rage that brings on the shaking. Come now."
They led the boy away.
"My lord husband," Sansa thought, as she contemplated the ruins of Winterfell. The snow had stopped, and it was colder than before. She wondered if Lord Robert would shake all through their wedding. At least Joffrey was sound of body. A mad rage seized hold of her. She picked up a broken branch and smashed the torn doll's head down on top of it, then pushed it down atop the shattered gatehouse of her snow castle. The servants looked aghast, but when Littlefinger saw what she'd done, he laughed.
"If the tales be true, that's not the first giant to end up with his head on Winterfell's walls."
"Those are only stories," she said, and left him there. Back in her bedchamber, Sansa took off her cloak and her wet boots and sat beside the fire. She had no doubt that she would be made to answer for Lord Robert's fit. "Perhaps Lady Lysa will send me away." Her aunt was quick to banish anyone who displeased her, and nothing displeased her quite so much as people she suspected of mistreating her son. Sansa would have welcomed banishment. The gates of the moon were much larger than the Eyrie, and livelier as well. Lord Nestor Royce seemed gruff and stern, but his daughter, Miranda, kept his castle for him, and everyone said how frolicsome she was. Even Sansa's supposed bastardy might not count too much against her, below. One of King Robert's base-born daughters was in service to Lord Nestor, and she and the Lady Miranda were said to be fast friends, as close as sisters. "I will tell my aunt that I don't want to marry Robert." Not even the High Septon himself could declare a woman married if she refused to say the vows. She wasn't a beggar, no matter what her aunt said. She was 13, a woman flowered and wed, the heir to Winterfell. Sansa felt sorry for her little cousin sometimes, but she could not imagine ever wanting to be his wife. "I would sooner be married to Tyrion again." If Lady Lysa knew that, surely she'd sent her away, away from Robert's pouts and shakes and runny eyes, away from Marillion's lingering looks, away from Pataya's kisses. "I will tell her, I will." It was late that afternoon when Lady Lysa summoned her. Sansa had been marshalling her courage all day, but no sooner did Marillion appear at her door than all her doubts returned. "Lady Lysa requires your presence in the High Hall." The singer's eyes undressed her as he spoke, but she was used to that. Marillion was comely, there was no denying it, boyish and slender, with smooth skin, sandy hair, a charming smile. But he had made himself well hated in the Vale, by everyone but her aunt and little Lord Robert. To hear the servants talk, Sansa was not the first maid to suffer his advances, and the others had not had Lothar Brune to defend them. But Lady Lysa would hear no complaints against him. Since coming to the Eyrie, the singer had become her favourite. He sang Lord Robert to sleep every night, and tweaked the noses of Lady Lysa's suitors, with verses that made mock of their foibles. Her aunt had showered him with gold and gifts, costly clothes, a gold arm ring, a belt studded with moonstones, a fine horse. She had given him her late husband's favourite falcon. It all served to make Marillion unfailingly courteous in Lady Lysa's presence, and unfailingly arrogant outside it. "Thank you," Sansa told him stiffly. "I know the way." He would not leave. My lady says to bring you.
Bring me?
She did not like the sound of that.
Are you a guardsman now?
Littlefinger had dismissed the heiress captain of guards and put Sir Lothar Brune in his place.
Do you require guarding?
Marillion said lightly. I am composing a new song, you should know. A song so sweet and sad, it will melt even your frozen heart. The Roadside Rose, I mean to call it, about a base-born girl so beautiful she bewitched every man who laid eyes upon her.
I am a Stark of Winterfell, she longed to tell him. Instead, she nodded, and let him escort her down the tower steps and along a bridge. The High Hall had been closed as long as she had been at the Eyrie. Sansa wondered why her aunt had opened it. Normally she preferred the comfort of her solar, or the cosy warmth of Lord Arryn's audience chamber with its view of the waterfall. Two guards in sky-blue cloaks flanked the carved wooden doors of the High Hall, spears in hand. "No one is to enter so long as Elaine is with Lady Lysa," Marillion told them.
"Aye."
The men let them pass, then crossed their spears. Marillion swung the doors shut and barred them with a third spear, longer and thicker than those the guards had borne.
Sansa felt a prickle of unease.
"Why did you do that?"
"My lady awaits you."
She looked about uncertainly. Lady Lysa sat on the dais in a high-backed chair of carved weirwood, alone. To her right was a second chair, taller than her own, with a stack of blue cushions piled on the seat. But Lord Robert was not in it. Sansa hoped he'd recovered. Marillion was not like to tell her, though. Sansa walked down the blue silk carpet between rows of fluted pillars, slim as lances. The floors and walls of the High Hall were made of milk-white marble veined with blue. Shafts of pale daylight slanted down through narrow arched windows along the eastern wall. Between the windows were torches, mounted in high iron sconces, but none of them was lit. Her footsteps fell softly on the carpet. Outside, the wind blew cold and lonely. Amidst so much white marble, even the sunlight looked chilly somehow, though not half so chilly as her aunt. Lady Lysa had dressed in a gown of cream-coloured velvet and a necklace of sapphires and moonstones. Her auburn hair had been done up in a thick braid and fell across one shoulder. She sat in the high seat, watching her niece approach, her face red and puffy beneath the paint and powder. On the wall behind her hung a huge banner, the Moon and Falcon, of House Arryn, in cream and blue. Sansa stopped before the dais and curtsied.
"My lady, you sent for me?"
She could still hear the sound of the wind and the soft chords Marillion was playing at the foot of the hall.
"I saw what you did,"
the Lady Lysa said. Sansa smoothed down the folds of her skirt.
"I trust Lord Robert is better. I never meant to rip his doll. He was smashing my snow castle. I only—"
"Will you play the coy deceiver with me?"
her aunt said.
"I was not speaking of Robert's doll. I saw you kissing him."
The High Hall seemed to grow a little colder. The walls and floor and columns might have turned to ice.
"He kissed me."
Lysa's nostrils flared.
"And why would he do that? He has a wife who loves him. A woman grown, not a little girl. He has no need for the likes of you. Confess, child, you threw yourself at him. That was the way of it."
Sansa took a step backward.
"That's not true." "Where are you going? Are you afraid? Such wanton behavior must be punished, but I will not be hard on you. We keep a whipping boy for Robert, as is the custom in the free cities. His health is too delicate for him to bear the rod himself. I shall find some common girl to take your whipping, but first you must own up to what you've done. I cannot abide a liar, Elaine."
"I was building a snow castle," Sansa said. "Lord Petyr was helping me, and then he kissed me. That's what you saw."
"Have you no honour?" her aunt said sharply. "Or do you take me for a fool?" You do, don't you? You take me for a fool. Yes, I see that now. I am not a fool. You think you can have any man you want because you're young and beautiful? Don't think I haven't seen the looks you give Marillion. I know everything that happens in the airy little lady, and I have known your like before, too. But you are mistaken if you think big eyes and strumpet smiles will win you Pattaya. He's mine. She rose to her feet. They all tried to take him from me, my lord father, my husband, your mother, Catelyn, most of all. She liked to kiss my Pattaya, too. Oh, yes, she did. Sansa retreated another step. My mother? Yes, your mother, your precious mother, my own sweet sister, Catelyn. Don't you think to play the innocent with me, you vile little liar? All those years in River Run, she played with Pattaya as if he were her little toy. She teased him with smiles and soft words and wanton looks, and made his nights a torment. No, my mother is dead, she wanted to shriek. She was your own sister, and she's dead. She didn't. She wouldn't. How would you know? Were you there? Lysa descended from the high seat, her skirt swirling. Did you come with Lord Bracken and Lord Blackwood the time they visited to lay their feud before my father? Lord Bracken's singer played for us, and Catelyn danced six dances with Pattaya that evening. Six! I counted. When the lords began to argue, my father took them up to his audience chamber, so there was no one to stop us drinking. Edmure got drunk, young as he was, and Pattaya tried to kiss your mother, only she pushed him away. She laughed at him. He looked so wounded I thought my heart would burst, and afterward he drank until he passed out at the table. Uncle Brynden carried him up to bed before my father could find him like that. But you remember none of it, do you? She looked down angrily. Do you? Is she drunk or mad? I was not born, my lady. You were not born, but I was. So do not presume to tell what is true. I know what is true. You kissed him. He kissed me, Sansa insisted again. I never wanted... Be quiet. I haven't given you leave to speak. You enticed him, just as your mother did that night in River Run, with her smiles and her dancing. You think I could forget? That was the night I stole up to his bed to give him comfort. I bled, but it was the sweetest hurt. He told me he loved me then, but he called me Cat, just before he fell back to sleep. Even so, I stayed with him until the sky began to lighten. Your mother did not deserve him. She would not even give him her favour to wear when he fought Brandon Stark. I would have given him my favour. I gave him everything. He is mine now, not Catelyn's, and not yours. All of Sansa's resolve had withered in the face of her aunt's onslaught. Lysa Arryn was frightening her as much as Queen Cersei ever had. "He's yours, my lady," she said, trying to sound meek and contrite. "May I have your leave to go?" "You may not." Her aunt's breath smelled of wine. "If you were anyone else, I would banish you, send you down to Lord Nestor at the Gates of the Moon or back to the Fingers. How would you like to spend your life on that bleak shore, surrounded by slatterns and sheep pellets? That was what my father meant for Pattaya. Everyone thought it was because of that stupid duel with Brandon Stark, but that wasn't so. Father said I ought to thank the gods that so great a lord as John Arryn was willing to take me soiled. But I knew it was only for the swords. I had to marry John, or my father would have turned me out, as he did his brother. But it was Pattaya I was meant for. I'm telling you all this so you will understand how much we love each other, how long we have suffered and dreamed of one another. We made a baby together. A precious little baby." Lysa put her hands flat against her belly, as if the child was still there. "When they stole him from me, I made a promise to myself that I would never let it happen again. John wished to send my sweet Robert to Dragonstone, and that sot of a king would have given him to Cersei Lannister, but I never let them. No more than I let you steal my Pattaya, Littlefinger. Do you hear me? Elaine, or Sansa, or whatever you call yourself. Do you hear what I'm telling you?" "Yes, I swear I won't ever kiss him again, or entice him." Sansa thought
That was what her aunt wanted to hear.
So, you admit it now. It was you, just as I thought. You are as wanton as your mother.
Lyser grabbed her by the wrist.
Come with me now. There's something I want to show you.
You're hurting me, Sansa squirmed. Please, Aunt Lyser, I haven't done anything, I swear it. Her aunt ignored her protests.
Marillion, she shouted. I need you, Marillion, I need you.
The singer had remained discreetly in the rear of the hall, but at Lady Arryn's shout he came at once.
My lady, play us a song. Play The False and the Fair.
Marillion's fingers brushed the strings.
The Lord, he came a-riding upon a rainy day. Hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey, nonny, nay.
Lady Lyser pulled at Sansa's arm. It was either walk or be dragged. So she chose to walk, halfway down the hall and between a pair of pillars, to a white weirwood door set in the marble wall. The door was firmly closed, with three heavy bronze bars to hold it in place, but Sansa could hear the wind outside worrying at its edges. When she saw the crescent moon carved in the wood, she planted her feet.
The moon door?
She tried to yank free.
Why are you showing me the moon door? You squeak like a mouse now, but you were bold enough in the garden, weren't you? You were bold enough in the snow.
The lady sat a-sewing upon a rainy day. Marillion sang, hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey.
Open the door, Lyser commanded. Open it, I say. You will do it, or I'll send for my guards.
She shoved Sansa forward.
Your mother was brave, at least. Lift off the bars.
If I do as she says, she will let me go. Sansa grabbed one of the bronze bars, yanked it loose, and tossed it down. The second bar clattered to the marble, then the third. She had barely touched the latch when the heavy wooden door flew inward and slammed back against the wall with a bang. Snow had piled up around the frame, and it all came blowing in at them, borne on a blast of cold air that left Sansa shivering. She tried to step backward, but her aunt was behind her. Lyser seized her by the wrist and put her other hand between her shoulder blades, propelling her forcefully toward the open door. Beyond was white sky, falling snow, and nothing else.
"Look down," said Lady Lyser. "Look down."
She tried to wrench free, but her aunt's fingers were digging into her arm like claws. Lyser gave her another shove, and Sansa shrieked. Her left foot broke through a crust of snow and knocked it loose. There was nothing in front of her but empty air and a Whey castle 600 feet below, clinging to the side of the mountain.
"Don't!" Sansa screamed. "You're scaring me!"
Behind her, Marillion was still playing his wood harp and singing, "Hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey."
"Do you still want my leave to go? Do you?"
"No." Sansa planted her feet and tried to squirm backward, but her aunt did not budge.
"Not this way, please."
She put a hand up, her fingers scrabbling at the doorframe, but she could not get a grip, and her feet were sliding on the wet marble floor. Lady Lyser pressed her forward inexorably. Her aunt outweighed her by 3 stone.
"The lady lay a-kissing upon a mound of hay."
Marillion was singing. Sansa twisted sideways, hysterical with fear, and one foot slipped out over the void. She screamed, "Hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey." The wind flapped her skirts up and bitted her bare legs with cold teeth. She could feel snowflakes melting on her cheeks. Sansa flailed, found Lysa's thick auburn braid, and clutched it tightly.
"My hair!" her aunt shrieked. "Let go of my hair!"
She was shaking, sobbing. They teetered on the edge. Far off, she heard the guards pounding on the door with their spears, demanding to be let in. Marillion broke off his song.
"Lyser, what is the meaning of this?"
The shout cut through the sobs and heavy breathing. Footsteps echoed down the high hall.
"Get back from there, Lyser. What are you doing?"
The guards were still beating at the door. Littlefinger had come in the back way, through the Lord's entrance, behind the dais. As Lysa turned, her grip loosened enough for Sansa to rip free. She stumbled to her knees, where Pataa Baelish saw her. He stopped suddenly.
"Elaine, what is the trouble here?"
"Her!" Lady Lysa grabbed a handful of Sansa's hair. "She's the trouble. She kissed you."
"Tell her," Sansa begged. "Tell her we were just building a castle."
"Be quiet," her aunt screamed. "I never gave you leave to speak. No one cares about your castle."
"She's a child, Lysa. Cat's daughter. What did you think you were doing?"
"I was going to marry her to Robert. She has no gratitude, no decency. You are not hers to kiss, not hers. I was teaching her a lesson, that was all."
"I see." He stroked his chin. "I think she understands now. Isn't that so, Elaine?"
"Yes," sobbed Sansa, "I understand. I don't want her here."
Her aunt's eyes were shiny with tears.
"Why did you bring her to the Vale, Pataa? This isn't her place. She doesn't belong here."
"We'll send her away, then, back to King's Landing, if you like."
He took a step toward them.
"Let her up now. Let her away from the door."
"No!"
Lysa gave Sansa's head another wrench. Snow eddied around them, making their skirts snap noisily.
"You can't want her. You can't. She's a stupid, empty-headed little girl. She doesn't love you the way I have. I've always loved you. I proved it, haven't I?"
Tears ran down her aunt's puffy red face.
"I gave you my maiden's gift. I will give you a son, too. But they murdered him with moon tea, with tansy and mint and wormwood. A spoon of honey and a drop of pennyroyal. It wasn't me. I never knew. I only drank what father gave me."
"That's past and done, Lysa. Lord Hoster's dead, and his old maester as well."
Littlefinger moved closer.
"Have you been at the wine again? You ought not to talk so much. We don't want Elaine to know more than she should, do we? Or Marillion."
Lady Lysa ignored that.
"Cat never gave you anything. It was me who got you your first post, who made John bring you to court so we could be close to one another. You promised me you would never forget that."
"Nor have I. We're together, just as you always wanted, just as we always planned. Just let go of Sansa's hair."
"I won't. I saw you kissing in the snow. She's just like her mother. Catelyn kissed you in the Godswood. But she never meant it. She never wanted you. Why did you love her best? It was me. It was always me."
"I know, love." He took another step. "And I am here. All you need to do is take my hand. Come on." He held it out to her. "There's no cause for all these tears."
"Tears, tears, tears," she sobbed hysterically. "No need for tears. But that's not what you said in King's Landing. You told me to put the tears in John's wine, and I did, for Robert and for us. And I wrote Catelyn and told her the Lannisters had killed my lord husband, just as you said. That was so clever. You were always clever. I told Father that. I said, Pataa's so clever. He'll rise high. He will. He will. And he's sweet and gentle. And I have his little baby in my belly. Why did you kiss her? Why? We're together now. We're together after so long, so very long. Why would you want to kiss her?"
"Lysa," Pataa sighed, "after all the storms we've suffered, you should trust me better. I swear I shall never leave your side again for as long as we both shall live."
"Truly?" she asked, weeping. "Oh, truly?"
"Truly. Now unhand the girl and come give me a kiss."
Lysa threw herself into Littlefinger's arms, sobbing. As they hugged, Sansa crawled from the moon door on hands and knees and wrapped her arms around the nearest pillar. She could feel her heart pounding. There was snow in her hair, and her right shoe was missing. It must have fallen. She shuddered and hugged the pillar tighter. Littlefinger let Lysa sob against his chest for a moment,
then put his hands on her arms and kissed her lightly. "My sweet, silly, jealous.